Welcome to tonight's council meeting. Could all members please turn their mobile phones to silent? And please could I also remind you to turn on your microphones when speaking for recording purposes. Thank you. Agenda item number one, minutes. Council meeting on the 23rd of January 2019. Is it the wish of the council that I sign the minutes of the council meetings held on the 23rd of January 2019 as an accurate record? Thank you. Thank you. Item number two, apologies for absence. Are there any apologies for absence?
Madam Mayor, apologies were received from councillors Cassidy, Holder, Rosenberg, and Coleman, and apologies for lateness were received from Councillor Johnson.
Thank you. Anyone else? Item three, Mayor announcements. I have none. Item four, declarations of interest. Are there any declarations of interest by councillors? I must advise members who are 2 months in arrears with their council tax payments, who cannot vote and report relating to budget settings. And item number five, public question time. No public questions were submitted. So we move on to item 6.1. Revenue budget and council tax levels 2019-20. I call upon the leader to formally move the report and recommendations.
Formally moved.
The agreed convention is that the Leader of the Council and the Leader of the Opposition have unlimited time to speak to this report. I call on the Leader of the Council, Councillor Cowan, Stephen Cowan, to speak, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. We meet tonight, my friends, in the most uncertain of times. I think it is fair to say that of all the many years that I have been the council leader or leader of the opposition, I never recall such circumstances. And our local finances, which we are set to discuss, are not separate to the national finances. Our local economy is not indifferent to what happens in the national economy. And indeed, the stability and effectiveness of the services many of our citizens rely on is not at all separate to what happens across our country. So when we look ahead at the next 12 months and we ponder what might happen, we do so with more uncertainty and more potential for chaos than I think we have seen in the post-war period. So these are indeed grave times. On the 14th of March, which is just 16 days away, we will find out if our country will crash out of the European Union without any deal whatsoever, or whether the chaos and confusion will be lengthened while Theresa May once again seeks to extend to carry on her negotiations by extending Article 50. By any measure, that is a Hobson's choice. It is absolutely clear that the third option, the option that Theresa May is arguing for, of her deal, has no majority in the House. And in just 31 days, if Theresa May once again fails to guarantee the long-term stability of our country, then we will indeed crash out of the European Union. Now, if I sound at all alarmed, it is because I am. And I think any sensible person should be. The British Medical Association, for example, have issued warnings, as have the Royal College of Nursing, as has National Health Service chiefs, as have health professionals up and down the country, of shortages of vital medicines, failures to recruit staff, and calamities facing the National Health Service that it believes will have the potential for serious disorder. Minette Batters, I don't know who has heard of Minette Batters, I am extremely impressed by her. She is the president of the National Farmers Union, not a union associated normally with the Labour Party, a conservative union by any measure. And she has described the potential of a no-deal Brexit as, and I quote, Armageddon. Armageddon. And she chastised last week the Secretary of State for Food and Agriculture as being the first Secretary of State in post-war Britain to begin seriously planning to make sure that Britons up and down our country have sufficient food. Britain's most senior police officer in London and across the UK, the Metropolitan Commissioner, has said that the potential of a no-deal Brexit for what she describes as serious public risk. Indeed, I met with police officers along with Councillor Fenimore earlier this week to talk and plan for what could happen, and was alarmed to see they were planning for civic disturbance around supermarkets should the food crisis occur. And the Chancellor of the Exchequer, again, someone not of this side of the chamber, the Chancellor of the Exchequer has warned that a no-deal Brexit will cause very significant disruption, that's a quote, to jobs, incomes, public services, and the economic well-being of Britons all around this country. Now, if that wasn't enough uncertainty for you, I propose that there is an extra dilemma that all of us who've cared about public services and worked hard to maintain them and argue for them have to face. We are now, my friends, in the 10th year of austerity. And as I think was ably demonstrated to anyone who tunes in to the debate that happened just a month ago, austerity is, was, and remains economically illiterate. But what that means to the citizens of our borough is that since David Cameron and Nick Clegg first found themselves in the Rose Garden at 10 Downing Street, there has been a staggering £73 million of cuts to this council from direct council funding. Funding that was previously the main source of funding for this local authority. Now that is a staggering thing. So let me tell you what we will do. Because it was only a few months ago that the vast majority of people in this borough gave us the biggest swing to Labour in the country and a mandate to govern as we have governed before. So I say now, let the message go out that we will not countenance any harm, any risk to the citizens of this borough. This is a safety first Brexit budget that puts the people of this borough and the needs they have in all their diversity first and foremost in every case. So can I at that point then turn to our colleagues amongst the officers and just say a huge thank you to everyone who has worked on the senior leadership team to run a very tight ship, to manage their budgets and to bring in the numbers as a balanced budget. I know it was tough, I know it required huge levels of creativity, but to know that we have what I think is the best team in local government working for us is one of the things that gives me confidence as we navigate this stormy sea. And to underline what I said, this year, despite the cuts, this Labour administration will impose a £3.3 million increase for children's services. £3.3 million that says to every child in this borough, you matter, you are our priority, which I know the parents of this borough and the carers of this borough share that value. And it's not just for children who need looking after in any civilised society. It is the elderly. It is our loved ones who once able maybe are now infirm, or people who were once able became disabled, or people who've been disabled all their lives. This council in 2019-2020 budget reaffirms its commitment to adult social care with a staggering 3.6 million extra investment in adult social care in the toughest of circumstances. Now, having held off from the government's ridiculous funding scheme for adult social care and managed to protect our residents at this huge period of uncertainty, this year we will introduce the government's scheme for paying for adult social care. And that will raise £1 million, not as much as we're making, but a very useful sum. And we will introduce an inflation rise, the CPI measure of 2.7, and those who are economically illiterate might struggle with that, but on this side of the benches, then I would reaffirm that that is in fact a real terms freeze. Not only are we going to make real terms freezes in council tax this year, a 2.7 inflation rise, we will also be making freezes. And again, for those who understand economics, that is a cut. So we will cut the price of school meals for the hard-working mums and dads and carers of our borough. We will cut the price of Meals on Wheels for the elderly, whose sometimes only human contact is the person who delivers their hot meal in the middle of the day. We will cut, in real terms, library charges. We will cut, in real terms, care line charges. In fact, in this budget, there are four pages of frozen charges, real terms cuts, for the services our residents rely on. Putting residents first. That's what this Labour administration is about, and that means modernising an old-fashioned bureaucracy and turning it into the most modern of organisations. And at the heart of that is ruthless financial efficiency, a scheme we introduced to make sure that we send the message to everyone, with even the smallest budgets, that that money is the public's money and we will spend it wisely. I would like to thank Max Schmidt, I would like to thank Rowan Rhee, I would like to thank PJ Murphy, and I would like to thank Ian Cassidy, who's not here. Very bad teeth, apparently. He will be back, though. I would like to thank those individuals for putting together, I think, the strongest financial management system that we see in local government. Thank you very much. Now, there have been times when it's been quite interesting being the council leader and carrying out negotiations with developers. The number of developers who said to me, you're not like the other lot, are you? You know, I mean, you know, I don't know why you do this silly thing where you don't take hospitality from us. I mean, what's the odd meal or trip somewhere? What's the problem with that, some of them have said. And let me tell you what the problem is. If you are going to look someone in the eye and maximise what you get in the way you negotiate, you not only need to know how to negotiate, you cannot have been sitting, drinking expensive wine, and hanging out and having chats with no officers present the night or the week or sometime in the 6 months before. It just can't be done. And if you don't believe me, stop anyone in the street. Climb on a Clapham omnibus. Ask them. And I think you'll find they agree. So I'm pleased that we've taken no hospitality, but there's something else I'm more pleased about. As of today, the figure we have negotiated from developers, being put to frontline services such as policing and fighting crime, being put to building affordable homes and protecting child centres and all the other things we do, the figure we have negotiated from developers stands at a staggering £643 million. Money that is better in our pockets, as I often tell the developers, than theirs, because we will spend it on the people that matter, the citizens of our borough. Now, we have done some very good work in terms of righting the wrongs that we inherited. And one of the things the management team have undertaken is setting about some of the dreadful contracts we inherited. Now, I think the story of the BT aggresso contract, which cost us £2.7 million a year when it should have been saving money. I think that's been well said. But it was a disgrace. And our partners in what was then called the Triborough were incompetent and maddening in their indifference to sorting it out. But we've sorted that out, and we've introduced our own system. Okay? But we've also negotiated what was the most expensive IT contract in London at £22 million. So what was £22 million is now £12 million. And indeed, you will be pleased to know, as I know our constituents when we carry out our surgeries, again, I talk to this side of the chamber, when we carry out our surgeries, our constituents, I don't think I've heard people cheer when I told them we're changing a contract. But the residents of the housing estates cheered when we told them Mighty was going and we were bringing in a new service. And that will save us money and it will improve the service. So, by the end of this year, and since 2014, not only have we negotiated vast sums, a British record for a landmass like this, of money from developers, we have also cut £80.2 million of wasteful spending. And at that point, I think, when you look at where we are and what we've done, I make a pledge now to anybody. I'm not saying there will never be any wastefulness. I'm sure there is. But when we find it, we will stop it. And even when we find efficiency, we will use technology and new working practice to make it more efficient. We will grasp modernity and the white heat of technology to make sure that this council drives efficiency like we've never seen before. And if you contrast that to what we thought we would be told when the Conservatives left office, I remember their leader at the time saying that we didn't have the guts to make tough choices. Well, we've made the tough choices, but I think we frame it in a very different way. So what you will see tonight is probably no alternative budget presented, which is not a surprise, despite the Conservatives didn't present a manifesto, which Labour always did. So no budget, no manifesto, no ideas for running the borough. But we know what they did, because we were here, and we saw it. We saw the community centres sold off. We were there at the protest. We heard what the public say. We watched as youth clubs sold off 10 years ago, and London is reaping the problems of it now. We saw homes sold off. The Capco deal is without doubt one of the worst land sale deals in history. Now that's why we've got some of the best city lawyers and other agents investigating that deal. We cannot see how a piece of land that by any measure was worth 1.5 to 2.25 billion was sold for just less than 110 million. And when we look at the deal they did, where they didn't index link the money we got to build replacement homes, and we look at the fact that that deal was for 25 years, it makes you wonder if there was any financial competence ever in that squalid administration. So not just did they sell it off at the wrong price, but they framed it different to us. Where they saw land and thought 110 million was a lot, we see people, we see families, we see people who love each other and work together and build a community. We see a community that came to rescue of people when Grenfell happened, and we see a community that is one of the strongest now. And that's why that community will win, and the developers and the Conservatives will lose. And we stand shoulder to shoulder with them in that fight as we begin to compulsory purchase the land in the Earls Court area and build homes for people, not overseas investors. So I probably don't need to remind you of the stealth tax increases, the talk about the 14.7% increase in parking that we were told in our early days, or about 200% increase in childcare charges, or the £700 increase the Conservatives introduced on meals and wheel charges, or their attempted tax on baby burials, which they had the gall to pretend was never planned and never in the papers, having scrambled to pull it out after PJ Murphy read the small print. But there is a contrast in this borough between the conservative philosophy that was then and the Labour, the Hammersmith and Fulham Labour philosophy that is now. And our view is that we can build the ever stronger economy that works for everybody. Now, one of the best meetings I've been to this year was this morning, ironically and coincidentally. We had a business breakfast, Andrew Jones and I, along with David Gann of Imperial and John Anderson of Imperial, and some of the most leading entrepreneurs anywhere in the world who just happened to be in the Hammersmith and Fulham, interested in the Hammersmith and Fulham industrial strategy. We had people talking to us about Meditech and FinTech, and how do we get more people into biotech? What can we do to have our affordable, flexible office space that this administration is delivering for startup entrepreneurs? How can we get more anchor businesses? Because we had Novartis move in, one of the world's biggest pharmaceutical companies, just before Christmas. So that, by any measure, should make anyone proud. An economy with people preparing to get the best possible jobs and startup opportunities brought to Hammersmith and Fulham and for the people of the borough. But the best bit of that conversation, the very best bit, was when we started talking about how do we take talent management and extend it to our education service. How do we take kids growing up in the White City Estate or Becklow Gardens or Clenutley Estate, or kids who are going to the best public schools, we don't care, and give them the best life opportunities and the strongest bit of the world economy for the future. And that's what this industrial strategy does. And what I liked about it is the people most enthused about it were some of the most hard-nosed, creative business people in the country. Now, that's the vision of a future we're trying to build. A future where everyone has a chance to build the life they want to be. And it's our job to get the garden right to let the flowers bloom. That's what Labour in Hammersmith and Fulham is about. At its best, a long-term vision. But not just that. I am deeply proud of the compassion that all of my colleagues have shown in the way we govern this administration. Not just the absolute commitment to be the only council to not charge people when they need adult social care in our borough. Imagine that, the only council to have abolished those charges, Hammersmith and Fulham. But also for the way we try and set the mark in the way we behave. Now, we stand here at this point in time having taken just another 10 child refugees during the biggest migrant and refugee crisis in the post-war period. Those people who meet those child refugees, and I encourage all of you to do it, will meet people sapped of hope, full of worry and anxiety, and desperate. And the words Hammersmith and Fulham have meant something to every one of those nearly 50 children we have brought and paid for. Now, there was a child who came across from a prison cell, which is where the struggling Greek economy puts many of the children, not because they're bad, but because their economy is struggling and they're desperately trying to cope with the child refugee crisis, who had lain on the floor, having tried to commit suicide for the umpteenth time. Now, we not only challenged the government when they said no one would take them, and we said Hammersmith and Fulham will. When they said, well, we're still not going to let them in, we went to the High Court. And we lost the case. And after we lost the case and the child tried to commit suicide again, we said, if that child does commit suicide, you will be responsible and we will let people know. That child's now living in Shepherd's Bush. He's having expensive care. But I tell you what that child is. It's not just one life, one human being who we've made a difference. Think back what politics is about. Think why we got involved with politics. I'm always amazed as I get older how short, how what seemed like a long time ago to me seems very recent now I'm in my 50s. Think about the Victorian eras. We read of children not being treated with any respect, being seen as almost vermin in some cases. And if you doubt that, then pick up any book of Dickens. And people, women and men, changed that world for us. Because they saw the humanity in those children. So that child and those other children we rescued, the child refugees, they're not just children in themselves. They are a mark we are laying down of no more These children have rights. Our country is a great country. At its best, it's respected those rights. And Hammersmith and Fulham will set the mark on that issue. And it is doing. And I am deeply proud to be investing money that we have got in that issue. Because it's bigger than just that issue. It's about what happens to all our children in the borough, born here or born overseas. So I can give you the statistics. I can talk about the two new youth clubs we're about to open and how we'll put facilities in. And we'll try and teach kids in those youth clubs some aspects of our new industrial strategy and give them chances at those jobs. I can talk about the 9 children's centres the amazing Sue McMillan saved in our first 6 months in office. And Paige, when the officer said, "Have you read the full reports?" And she said, "Can we turn to 272, please?" And there it was, closing 9 children's centres, which they said was in the plan we inherited. We can talk about the new civic campus, which changes to end the idea of a town hall separate from the public, but a town hall that has social housing in, a town hall that has school kids doing homework in, a town hall that entrepreneurs sitting around their laptops working in, a different type of government. We can talk about many, many different things. The 3,149 affordable homes that, at our least ambitious, we will build by the end of our second term in the 8 years, by the time that term comes to an end. The new food bank that we're going to open in Sands End. Now, I caution here, because it is something for us to be proud that the Trussell Trust say we're the best council in England and the country at tackling food poverty. And I am proud that we put benefits advisors into the food banks to make sure that the 50% of people who are coming to the food banks are coming because they haven't had their benefits properly processed, benefits they were entitled to. So I'm proud we've done our bit. I'm proud that Sue Fenimore phoned up Daphne Aitkins the day after we won and said, "How do we help you put you out of business?" And she said, "Let's meet up and plot." And we've done that ever since. But I'm telling you something else. When I was in the White City Food Bank and a woman in her late 30s was introduced to me by Daphne, a woman who had a job, who had kids, but had been given food tokens. And when I asked her if she was okay, she started crying. First just a little bit and then a lot. We had to go and sit down. That is something that I'm ashamed of. I'm ashamed of it because I love this country and we're better than that. We're just better than that. So, we will carry on with this year ahead, building a society that we try to make better. We're going to make mistakes, but when we do, we'll fix them. And we will get things right. We'll build an economy that works for everybody, instead of just for people currently with their nose squashed up against the window, knowing that the new jobs normally aren't for them. We'll build a society and a way of governing that not just respects people's money and has ruthless financial efficiency at its heart, but is compassionate and tries to talk to the best of British values. And we will do that with vigour, and we have something else as well. We have, in my long experience as an elected representative of this borough, the best Labour group we have ever had. And the fact that we have got this team means that we'll not only achieve that, but we'll achieve many things as well. Thank you very much. I commend this budget.
Thank you. I now call on the Leader of the Opposition, Councillor Andrew Brown, to speak.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. My speech starts remarkably similar to the Leader of the Councils, but then diverges somewhat. To misquote the apocryphal Chinese saying, we certainly live in interesting times, potentially at the crossroads of a change to both our geopolitical relationship with the European Union and the political system in this country. For this reason, in response to the Labour administration's budget, and after such an enjoyable debate on macroeconomics at our last meeting, I thought I would look back at the history of our borough's finances before discussing the present budget and concluding with a few thoughts on the future. Before I go back too far, however, I just want to thank the new councillor for Fulham Reach for her fantastic quote on Gordon Brown being the greatest chancellor this country has ever seen. It's certainly gone down brilliantly with our donors. As many of the new members of the Labour group have such a rose-tinted view of their party's economic record in government, I thought they might enjoy a trip down memory lane in our borough. If you like Gordon Brown selling off the country's gold reserves at rock-bottom prices, you'll love this. To cut a long, hapless story short, the last Labour administration very nearly bankrupted the borough and came very close to being taken over by government commissioners. The reason for this was that Labour-run LBHF had entered into hundreds of interest rate swaps. Some councils were doing this to hedge borrowing. In LBHF, however, the council were doing this on a speculative basis. So large was this activity that it accounted for close to 1% of global interest rate swaps. At its peak, the council had borrowings of around 400 million, but had entered into contracts, all betting interest rates would fall, on around £6 billion of debt. Unfortunately for the reckless council, interest rates went up against the bets that the council had made. The scandal was brought to the Audit Commission and the District Auditor, and the borough was only saved when the courts ruled that the trades had been made illegally. They were ultra vires. Despite the significant illegality and irresponsibility, the Labour administration claimed that they were unaware of what was going on. In fact, nobody took responsibility for what had happened, instead blaming the affair on an over-enthusiastic summer intern. You may wonder why I'm bringing this up, but as members of the current Labour group were either councillors or activists at the time, it is relevant, especially as the now MP for Hammersmith was a leading Labour councillor at that time, becoming deputy leader shortly after the swap scandal. As this council seems to be so keen on criticising our respective MPs, I do wonder how the Labour group feels after joining us with us to make such an unequivocal stand against anti-Semitism, to hear that at a meeting of the PLP last summer, according to Labour List, the MP for Hammersmith was one of only four MPs to vote against adopting the full IHRA definition. Another was Chris Williamson. What damning company to keep. Whilst the swap scandal may have been the most notorious, this was just part of a wider profligate administration that saw the council's general fund debt increase from £123 million in 1993 to £169 million in 2006. At the same time, the council tax increasing from £706 for a bandy property in 1999 to 2000 to £916 in 2006-2007, the last year of the Labour administration, an increase of 30%. The most cynical figures at that time was the Labour outlier of a council tax freeze in 2002. I wonder what happened that year, followed by a close to 10% rise the following year. In contrast, the Conservative administration, which inherited a general fund debt of £169 million, which meant that the borough was spending £5 million a year on interest payments alone, reduced that to £43 million in 2014, with an interest bill of less than £2 million. At the same time, we reduced council tax by 3%, 7 years out of eight, cutting the bandy levy from £916 to £735, a cumulative reduction of 20%. Not only did we reduce the council's debt, reducing the crippling level of debt interest, but we also ensured that residents kept more of their hard-earned money, with council tax particularly affecting low earners and the elderly. In cash terms, bandy council taxpayers saved £1,371, not an inconsequential sum. You may scoff at our administration's record and frequently do. You like to talk about it so much, so I thought I'd talk about yours. But these figures are hard to argue with. You may not have liked some of the decisions that were taken to enable those improvements in our borough's finances to occur. If I had been leader of the Conservatives or any of my colleagues here at that point, things may have been done slightly differently, but the overall direction and success of our council in reducing council tax and debt at the same time as improving services is one that we are rightly proud of, and the Conservative leaders of the Council over our administration should be proud of. And what is more, has left the Council with a healthier balance sheet and lower interest payments, helping you weather the challenging financial environment for local councils over the last few years. But what was the Labour Party's position when they were in opposition? I remember from the two budget speeches that I heard from the then Leader of the Opposition, now Leader of the Council, that we weren't cutting council tax enough. So they weren't ideologically opposed to the cutting of council tax or making savings. If Labour were in control over those years, apparently they would have cut council tax by much more than the Conservatives did. I also remember the Leader saying that they would also stop making money from bus cameras and yellow box junctions. So what happened in the first 4 years of the Labour administration? They cut council tax by 1%, once over 4 years. Bus lane and yellow box fines also went up. Ironically, the increase in these fines was more than enough to pay for the 1% cut in council tax. Which brings us to the present day. Despite pledging in their 2018-22 business plan to keep council tax low, whilst at the same time in their election literature and on their Twitter banner, ambiguously claiming that they have, or pledging to, cut council tax, I'm sure many residents will be extremely disappointed with this 4.7% increase, which, helpfully for them, falls just below the threshold for a public referendum. But to be fair, let's break down that council tax increase as the council report has done. Yes, the government's grant to local authorities has reduced, but less this year than the majority of the last 10 years. I wonder why it is that council tax didn't increase over the last few years, but just after the election has done. We recognise the challenges and pressures on social care, however, and the knock-on impact that has on the NHS. We would therefore also levy the adult social care preset of 2% and support you in doing so. Moving on to the next paragraph in the report, I must admit that I chuckled when I saw that the council were adjusting council tax by 2.7%. I think the word you're looking for there is increasing. We also believe that the inflation figure used is misleading. As you state in paragraph 4.3, you were pegging the increase to the August 2018 Consumer Price Index, which is below the August Retail Price Index increase of 3.5%. Those facts are true. However, that figure is an outlier in last year's trend and the highest since February of 2018. Surely an increase that is based on inflation should be pegged to a more up-to-date figure, as the most recent CPI figure for January 2019 is 1.8% and the RPI is at just 2.5%, lower even than the figure you have chosen. To use an out-of-date inflation figure to justify your increase in council tax is slightly bemusing. I think it's also important at this point, following the order of the report, to note the very significant increase in the Mayor's preset of 8.9%. As the Mayor has broken most of his promises he has made, this comes as no surprise. Some will say that this is justified to increase police funding to combat the violent crime crisis in London. However, as the GLA Conservatives proposed in their amendment to the Mayor's budget, which was voted down on Monday, they call on the Mayor to reduce some of his bloated budgets down to 2016-17 levels, the year that he took office, such as his staffing budget and PR budget. By doing so, the Mayor could free up nearly £83 million to invest in new police officers, allowing the Met to put 14,000 extra police officers on our streets, and at the same time freeze the non-police element of the mayoral precept. That brings us to the Mayor also scrapping the buy one, get one free scheme for local authorities funding additional police officers. This will have a significant impact on our borough. The funding of additional police officers was something that was pioneered by our Conservative administration and continued by the Labour administration, which we welcome. We call on the administration to work with us and other London boroughs to campaign against the Mayor's decision. Where this administration gets things right, we will support it. For example, the Disabled People Strategy is an initiative that we welcome and congratulate the Council on. The increased spending on adult social care and children's services is another decision we welcome. We also welcome freezes to cancel fees and charges. I'm also pleased you had such a nice breakfast at Imperial this morning. In my view, the finest university in the world, and I'm delighted that the borough is growing and strengthening the relationship with them. I hope you sent a letter of thanks to Stephen Greenhouse. There has been a noticeable acceleration in developments that this administration is giving planning permission to since the election. The number of units given permission and the number of completions that were not the legacy of our administration was pitiful over the last 4 years, but that has now changed. Although we welcome additional housing, especially social housing, we do not support the extraordinary high tower blocks granted permission over the last few months. The two most notable examples of regeneration in our borough are Old Oak and Earl's Court. Old Oak is not under the control of the council, although the leader sits on its board. We believe that this important scheme is not progressing quickly enough and call on both sides of this council to work with their colleagues either in City Hall, other boroughs or government to bring pressure to bear to speed up the plans for this transformative redevelopment. With regard to Earl's Court, and obviously it's something that's been discussed tonight and at length on previous occasions, what I said a few minutes ago about changes to redevelopments that our former administration agreed stands. If you put something forward that is an improvement, then we would support it. You have, however, pointed the finger at senior members of our previous administration regarding the advice that they received over Earl's Court. Whilst that redevelopment scheme is, of course, controversial and hugely uncertain, at full council in July, you made certain allegations against former members of the Conservative group that suggested subtly or less so that impropriety had taken place. As the decisions over Earl's Court were taken either before I was elected or shortly after, I of course spoke to numerous people, both in our group and outside. Our group unsurprisingly viewed your views as politically motivated nonsense and attacks. But more interestingly, senior officers stated that their interpretation of events and the advice received did not correspond to that of the administration councillors, and the advisers were from senior and respected sources in their respective fields. I will also at this point out the unpleasant and untrue smears made by one of the administration's cabinet members at the last meeting over the sale of street properties. Speaking with former colleagues, they completely deny your innuendo and suggest you either name them and what you are claiming, or be quiet on the matter. You should also be careful of the repeated spears that you make on this and other matters. Let us not forget that this administration has appointed a former Labour councillor of another borough as a housing director, although they have now moved on. They have also appointed, as chairman of the Residents' Commission on Council Housing, the Right Honourable Keith Hill, a former Labour MP and a former boss of one of the administration's cabinet members. More recently, they have appointed an architectural practice owned by a Labour peer to design the town hall redevelopment. Some may say, jobs for the boys. Moving away from redevelopments and appointments, there are other areas where we believe the council could be doing more. Infrastructure is certainly one of those, both with regards to the Flyunder as well as Crossrail 2 at Imperial Wharf. From an air pollution perspective, we believe that lessons could be learned from other boroughs that have higher rates of electric car uptake. Multiple boroughs are investing in and already have installed electric car charging points in lampposts, which is much more popular than the model used in this borough, although we welcome the principle as well as the aim of reducing air pollution. On air pollution, we also call on this administration to join with us and other boroughs, and even a Labour PPC, Fighter Shaheen, to campaign against the Mayor's ill-thought-through changes to the ultra-low emission zone. We support the principle of this scheme, which was initially proposed by the Conservatives, but agree with Pfizer that the Mayor's changes to the scheme are aggressive, unfair, and will hit the poor hardest, especially tradesmen and lower-income families who can't afford to change their vehicle to a cleaner one. The Mayor's punitive decision for hard-working families is particularly hypocritical, as he was a Minister of State for Transport in the Gordon Brown Labour government, you'll enjoy this, that actively incentivised and encouraged people to buy diesel vehicles. However, to wrap up our thoughts on this budget, we support the adult social care precept However, we do not believe in adding additional burden to the taxpayers of this borough. If in control, instead of increasing core council tax by 2.7%, we would aim at this time to at a minimum freeze it, with an aspiration to cut it by 2% to mitigate the increased cost to residents of the precept. We would fund this by reducing the amount of taxpayers' money spent on the council's PR department, which we know has recently criticised for its behaviour towards local bloggers and journalists. We would also commit the borough to working better with neighbouring boroughs. Unlike this Labour administration, which we are told by a cabinet member in a North London borough, is universally disliked across the London Labour Party. We believe in good working relationships. We would take Hammersmith and Fulham back into Tri-Borough, and with a positive approach to this collaboration, learning lessons from the past experience, we would save money for our residents and, more importantly, improve services. These partnerships can only work if there is a spirit of mutual trust and respect. Whilst this is easy when the partners are the same political persuasion, this does not have to be the case. This administration tries to claim that Tri-Borough didn't save us money, which officers do not agree with, and points out and constantly point out its failings. They also, however, overlook how much officers enjoy the opportunity of working with and learning from colleagues in other boroughs and the benefits that had for their professional development. Maybe Tri-Borough under this administration didn't deliver the savings that it did under ours, but I've been told a story by the leader of Westminster Council, Nicky Aitken, which I believe reflects why the partnership didn't work with this leadership. The day after the Westminster Bridge terror attack, the first attack on mainland Britain in a decade, the three leaders of the Tri-Borough were due to meet in Hammersmith Town Hall. Nicky requested that due to the need to support the Metropolitan Police and deal with the horrific attack and its aftermath, whether the meeting could be postponed, held in Westminster, or done as a conference call. The leader of this council refused, insisting that it went ahead in Hammersmith. This typifies perhaps why your administration wasn't able to work with the other two boroughs and deliver savings and improvements for our residents. So I will conclude my speech where I started. We are living in uncertain times. Nobody knows if or how Brexit will develop or its impact on this country or our borough, either economically or politically. What I can say with a degree of certainty is that the Labour Party is more divided than the Conservative Party. How that will play out in 2022 and beyond, who knows? But what I can say in the short or medium term is that when you do things that we believe are right for this borough, we will support them. And when you do things that we oppose and are the wrong decisions, we will highlight them as a responsible opposition will do. Thank you.
Thank you. I now call on Councillor Christabel Cooper to speak for the administration. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. As a former student of medieval history, I'm very grateful to the Leader of the Opposition for his extremely interesting lecture on the medieval history of budgets in this council, which was interesting but slightly irrelevant, and also, I believe, inaccurate as the swap scandal began under a Tory administration. I'm also grateful to Councillor Brown for acknowledging that he had actually listened to my last speech and appreciated the sentiment. It had been worrying me slightly that perhaps I'd been a little too subtle and hadn't quite got my point across. But yes, I'm glad he has acknowledged that my main point was Gordon Brown rocks. And because my next point was going to be that's not the only thing that rocks, this Labour administration rocks. Like the previous Labour government, this administration represents the best of the Labour Party, a Labour Party which believes in fighting for social justice, in the humanity which the leader referred to in regard to child refugees, and in the general power of government to make people's lives better, but which does not believe that it has an automatic right to simply help itself to other people's money. There are many wealthy people in this borough. The average income is one of the highest in the country, but that average masks the fact that there are many people here who earn very ordinary wages, who get up to go to work every day, who work long hours, who get squashed on the district line, as I was this evening, but who don't take home a huge amount of money. So when we ask them to pay council tax, We have to make sure that we are taking the least amount in order to deliver what our residents need and expect from a progressive Labour administration. So that's why we kept the council tax so low. I remember when I was campaigning last year, a lot of people on the doorstep were actually quite suspicious about it. They were sort of asking, you know, what essential services have you cut in order to keep the tax so low? And it was great to be able to tell them about the hundreds of millions of pounds that the leader just referred to that we got out of property developers. In some cases, by reopening negotiations that the Conservative administration had closed. It was a message that went well down well across the political spectrum, because it turns out Tory voters don't like being ripped off any more than Labour ones. And just while we're on this and talking about money and businesses, the Tories have always been seen as the party of business, and yet, unbelievably, the National Party has decided to flush that reputation down the toilet by bringing the country to the brink of economic catastrophe through its apocalyptically poor handling of Brexit. But being pro-business does not, in fact, consist of having long boozy lunches or jetting off to Cannes and then agreeing to do whatever it was the CEO last said to you. That's only being pro that particular business. It's not pro that business's competitors. It's not pro a genuinely competitive market. It's not pro customer. It's not pro resident. It's not pro entrepreneurs who are looking for space and support to start their businesses. This administration is pro all of those things. And if it was, and if it wasn't, then as someone who's worked in the private sector all my life, I wouldn't want to be part of it. But now we come to today, when we are proposing an increase in council tax in line with inflation. This comes across against a background where local government funding continues to decrease, something I know the Tory group has been critical of, along with many of their colleagues in local government across the country. What is clear is that Conservative-led governments from 2010 onwards have regarded local government as a soft target for cuts, perhaps because they hoped people wouldn't notice. It's true that many of the most expensive council services are not things that every resident uses, so perhaps they thought lots of people wouldn't realise that adult social care is underfunded, or that council houses weren't particularly well maintained. But voters are starting to join the dots. They're linking the crisis in the NHS to the crisis in social care, and they're seeing valuable services like libraries and children's centres disappear. We don't want that to happen to our residents in Hammersmith and Fulham, but neither do we want to end up like Tory-run Northamptonshire in bankruptcy. At the last council meeting, it seems that some of the Tory group needed some education about the global financial crisis. I don't know, perhaps I've been missing something about the equally well-known Northamptonshire financial crisis, which the administration was powerless to deal with, or perhaps it was just simply incompetence. At any rate, that's not going to happen here. I'm astonished that Councillor Brown wanted to quibble with the inflation figure that we're using, given that we still stand a significantly large chance of crashing out of the EU with no deal, in which case the Bank of England has predicted that inflation may go up to 6.5%. So it's quite extraordinary that you don't think that that's a sensible approach, given that other Tory-run councils have gone into bankruptcy. The only sensible course is to take the one that this administration is taking in raising council tax in line with inflation, and therefore I commend this budget.
Thank you. I now call on Bora Kwan to speak for the administration.
I'm going to try and speak briefly on our administration's budget for the next year. I will confess that I'm someone who has always preferred words to numbers, but I wanted to speak about what the budget and actually what being part of an administration with fiscal responsibility for the wealth of our borough means as I understand it. So as a newly elected councillor, the idea of being part of a group in charge of the purse strings of Hammersmith and Fulham is a responsibility that does weigh on my mind. Government funding to local authorities, as we all know, just keeps on shrinking. Budgets are still on a downward spiral, and the terrifying spectre of a no-deal Brexit just won't go away because the government refuses to, in spite of all the reason and common sense that should actually rule out the economic consequences of such a horrific prospect. There is no extra money. What there is are decisions that we have to take. What we have are decisions on social care, welfare, education, safety, environment, and all the other aspects that make up our community. We've got decisions to make on prosperity, on our borrowed shared collective prosperity that will affect our lives, our children's lives and generations to come. It's these decisions that we have to make in our budget, and actually these decisions are what give me hope in spite of the cuts and the looming whatever will happen with Brexit. They show me the opportunities for growth that we have to grab but also create. Now, I have a dual background. I was born in South Korea and then very much grown like a weed in southwest London. And I was very honoured recently to be able to help the Korean consulate in the UK host a delegation visiting local Korean government officials and politicians around our town hall and introduce them to our council and also to you, Madam Mayor. We made an impromptu visit to the roof of the town hall, and before anyone in health and safety asked, it was a leader's decision, not mine. We didn't lose any members of the delegation, so we just about got away with it. Whilst enjoying the spectacular views from the top of the town hall, one of the visiting officials remarked on how our borough seemed to be perfectly placed as part of London, but with easy access to Heathrow and transport links, to be a base for many international businesses. Our location is what makes our administration's industrial strategy so vital for the future of our borough. It's not just about attracting businesses to the area, but it's also about creating wealth and job opportunities for our borough's youth and residents. Now, in my day job, I work for a media tech startup. It's a job that I love, but the downside is, like my former councillor has just said, I have to schlep on the district line all the way to Aldgate East in rush hour. So the reason that we have to do this is, you know, as a startup, that's where London's tech scene is. Silicon Roundabout, Shoreditch, that's where it's based. There's no need for that. That's, you know, when I speak to my colleagues and partners who fly in through Gatwick and Heathrow, they all remark on the difficulties of having to travel into East London. Our industrial strategy and the position of our borough create prime opportunity for a West London tech hub. There are other decisions that we need to make in our budget. The decision to keep home care charges free for our residents is one of the decisions that I think that we're all particularly proud of and our residents really appreciate. One of our residents, Victoria Brignall, who sits as a co-opted member on our health and social care pack, quite rightly pointed out that home care charges are a tax. They're a tax on disabled, elderly and infirm residents. There is no extra money. So keeping home care charges free is a decision that our administration has made and maintained. We also have made a decision to take a big fight on our hands, which is the fight to protect West Kent and Gibbs Green Estates from Capco and the complete and utter mess that they have left of the Earls Court redevelopment. Unpicking the consequences of that unfathomable and absolutely incomprehensible decision of that mangled deal is a decision that we decided to make, and it's